Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the April issue of EMed Home's EMcast. This is Amol Mattu at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and once again, welcome back. Hey, just another final reminder, there's two really great upcoming conferences this month in April. If you're listening to this on April 1st, this is not an April Fool's joke, by the way, you've only got 2 days to register for the free virtual 9th Annual University of Maryland Emergency Cardiology Symposium. Check out the website at ecs.umem.org. Again, this is our 9th Annual Emergency Cardiology Symposium. It's all virtual and it is entirely free. If you want CME, there's a little bit of a charge for it, but it's cheap. And if you don't care about CME, it's totally free, but you've got to register. So go to that website, register, and you can watch it real-time live stream, or if the time zones or your work schedule doesn't work out to watch it real time, you will get a link in order to get the recordings for this conference. We're going to have about 6 speakers coming from various parts of the country and also one from Europe to give us some updates on a potpourri of different challenging topics in emergency cardiology. It's very, very relevant to all acute care physicians out there. So share the website with your colleagues, with your friends, your neighbors, everyone, and anyone who is interested in emergency cardiology, ecs.umem.org. And also April 8th and April 10th, we've got a new conference. It's the Beats and Bones Conference. Beats and Bones. The website is beatsnbones.com. Again, beatsnbones.com. This is a combined cardiology and orthopedics conference. Day one is Monday, April 8th. Day two is Wednesday, April 10th. 2 full days. Again, it's all virtual. We're going to do it by Zoom. And the reason we're combining emergency cardiology and emergency orthopedics is because these are the two areas of emergency medicine that represent the highest risk in terms of QA and M&M and litigation in emergency medicine, emergency cardiac cases and emergency orthopedic cases, believe it or not. So we're putting these two things together. They don't seem related, but that's how they relate to each other. And it's going to be a really, really great conference. That one's not free, but again, we're keeping the cost for that down, and there is going to be CME available for that as well. So check out that website, www.beatsnbones.com. All right, two really great conferences. All right, well, on to the April issue of the EMcast. This month, we've got 3 really fantastic topics. We're going to kick things off by talking about subacute bacterial peritonitis. Speaking of liver disease, we haven't done that in quite some time, but there is a really nice review article published in the emergency medicine literature that one of my colleagues, Dr. Gentry Wilkerson, is going to take us through. Then we're going to talk about a recently published ACEP clinical policy. You know, these ACEP clinical policies are things I think that we all need to know about in emergency medicine. And also for U.S. physicians, these are the things that oftentimes show up on the LLSA reading list for board certification and oftentimes represent boards type of questions. And also they are sometimes held out as surrogates for standards of care. We really should know about this. And even putting the risk management and standards of care stuff aside, it represents evidence-based approach to how to take care of these patients. Anyway, this clinical policy focuses on managing patients with severe agitation, definitely one of the more challenging things we face in the emergency department. And you might think you know everything there is about taking care of patients with severe agitation. Just give them big doses of haloperidol and big doses of diphenhydramine and load them up with benzodiazepines. And you know what? I think the literature has taken us beyond that into safer and more effective therapies. So check out that podcast. And then we're going to wrap things up with a discussion on geriatric trauma. This is based on some national guidelines that have been put out by the trauma societies and also some nice papers that have been put together. So one of my other colleagues is going to take us through that literature. So again, starting out, subacute bacterial peritonitis, then severe agitation, then geriatric trauma. Let's go ahead and get started. All right, well, welcome back to EMcast. You know, I was looking back over the recent topics that we've covered. We haven't really discussed much GI pathology in a little while.
So we're going to turn our attention back to the abdomen, namely the liver. Now, I don't recall that we've ever really spent much time or any time talking specifically about the liver, but there's a really nice article published this past year in American Journal of Emergency Medicine, which was one of these emergency medicine updates that they publish regularly. The authors were Britt Long and Michael Gottlieb, and the topic was spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. This is definitely a bread and butter topic, one of those things that we study a bit about for the boards. But as I looked over the title of this, I figured, well, I pretty much know what I need to know about SBP. But then as I skimmed through the article, I realized that I really don't. And there's quite a bit of stuff in this article that was really good stuff for me to learn or relearn about. So anyway, we're going to spend some time on this article. Joining us today to take us through this article is one of my colleagues, Dr. Gentry Wilkerson. Gentry's been on the EM cast before on discussing a potpourri of different topics. He's one of our assistant residency directors, but more importantly, he is one of our leading educators and researchers in the department and helps as a mentor for many of the residents doing research. And I've mentioned this a handful of times before. He has a couple of interests and topics on which he really is a recognized expert. One of them is angioedema. And one of the other topics that he has spent some time talking about, on which actually later today for Maryland ASAP, he's going to be spending some time on a webinar discussing, and that is going to be the opioid crisis and the use of buprenorphine and some other medications to help with patients that are addicted to opioids. So anyway, Gentry, welcome back to EMCast. It's been quite some time.
Oh, it's great to be back. And it's exciting to talk about this topic. You mentioned that I've got some various interests, but actually one of the first publications I ever did back in 2009 was the use of paracentesis in the assessment of patients with ascites. So, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and I'm excited to be able to talk about it. And speaking of that, we actually did a podcast on assessment and evaluation of patients with cirrhosis back in 2018. It's been 6 years. I can't believe you don't remember that podcast with me. Amal, I'm flabbergasted.
Well, that was quite some time ago. That was several hundred podcasts ago, it seems. But I have vague recollection of discussing the liver on EMCast before, but we really don't spend much time on this. So it's great that you're back for this. And I didn't know about your interest in the liver and cirrhosis and SBP. So it's a coincidence that this was a topic on which you first published many years ago. So
Yeah,
anyway, well,
definitely.
let's go ahead and jump right in. Gentry, the article starts out with some surprising numbers about the frequency of this condition. And we see a lot of what we refer to as liver patients. We see a lot of patients in the emergency department with liver disease. There's a liver transplant program and so on. But even then, the numbers were still a bit surprising to me when they reported this. And there's a higher morbidity and mortality than I was aware of. Can you take us through some of this background information in the paper before we jump into the meat?
Yeah, absolutely. The liver has to be respected. I don't think it gets the respect that it deserves. Maybe it's the Rodney Dangerfield of organs, but the numbers are astounding that they talk about in this paper. So patients that have decompensated cirrhosis, they often get infections, and when they present to the emergency department, infections are the problem, and they account for 25 to 46% of the reasons why patients get admitted to the hospital. And of course, the most common infection that these patients get is spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. And when they have infections, their mortality is increased fourfold. So over 30% of the infections are due to SBP. And patients with ascites that get admitted and admitted for any reason, SBP is present in 5 to 30% of patients. And sometimes those patients are asymptomatic or have very mild symptoms. So it's a diagnosis that can kind of lurk underwater, and we have to be on our guard for it. The mortality is really high. It ranges from 15 to 40% per episode of SBP, and at 1 year, the survival is only 40% after an episode of spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. So definitely a disease to be aware of and know how to treat and give the patients the best outcome possible.
Absolutely. Well, the article is organized into a series of questions and answers, which makes things very nice, very clinical. So let's just go ahead through their questions. First of all, first question, what are the major risk factors for SBP?
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that spontaneous bacterial peritonitis almost always occurs in ascites due to cirrhosis. It can happen in ascites due to other reasons, like end-stage renal disease, heart failure, peritoneal carcinomatosis, and pancreatic disease. But usually when we see SBP, it's in a patient with ascites due to cirrhosis. And most of the patients that get it, they've got decompensated cirrhosis. So they're going to be Child Pugh class C, which already gives them a lot of risk factors for developing SBP. And these risk factors include having upper GI bleed. So 25 to 65% of patients with ascites who come in with upper GI bleed are going to have spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. Another major risk factor is a low acidic protein concentration, so less than 1.5 grams per deciliter. And that's especially a risk factor when it's combined with a Child Pugh score greater than or equal to 9, a serum bili level greater than or equal to 3, elevated creatinine greater than or equal to 1.2, or a BUN greater than or equal to 25, or sodium less than 130. Another major risk factor is a history of prior SBP. So patients that get SBP, they tend to recur. The recurrence rate is about 70% unless prophylaxis is given to the patients. Other risk factors include a serum total bili of greater than 2.5 and malnutrition. Some other risk factors that have been documented are use of PPIs, older age, refractory ascites, and if they've had endoscopic management of their varices.
Well, when do you think we should suspect SBP? Granted, there's all these risk factors, but gosh, that includes so many patients. So when should we really suspect SBP?
I think for the emergency physician, anytime a patient with ascites is in the emergency department, we have to think spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, no matter what they're coming in for. Just think about it. Doesn't mean that you have to evaluate them. If they're there for a sprained toe, probably don't need to evaluate them. But always be thinking SBP in these patients because the mortality is so high and it is a tricky diagnosis to make sometimes. The classic presentation is fever, abdominal pain, or tenderness, and altered mental status, but as you've taught us, the classic presentation means that we almost never see that. So things to look out for is an abnormal temperature, high fevers, or being cold, hypothermia. And hypothermia is associated with worse outcomes than being febrile. And sometimes that threshold of fever is recommended to be dropped a little bit because they may not mount as much of a fever response as a normal person. So some people say 37.8 Celsius should be the threshold. Abdominal pain or tenderness, it's really a sensitive finding for SBP of 94.1%, but it's pretty nonspecific, 15.1%. The abdominal pain is typically diffuse, and patients rarely will develop rigidity with it. Altered mental status typically goes with SBP, but a lot of these patients, they already have some baseline encephalopathy, so it can be kind of hard to tease out how off from their baseline they are. And sometimes this altered mental status can be really subtle. So it's good to have family members or other people that can kind of give some collateral information to let you know whether the patient's just not acting right. What we have found out is that our clinical gestalt is not reliable. The idea that we can make a determination whether somebody has SBP just by kind of doing our history and physical, it's really poorly sensitive and we shouldn't rely on gestalt.
Great, great points. Well, do patients with SBP routinely require blood product transfusions to address coagulation problems or platelet abnormalities?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting topic because patients with cirrhosis, especially when they develop ascites, they're going to have liver dysfunction and they're going to develop thrombocytopenia and their coagulation panel testing is going to be abnormal. So 70% of patients are going to have an abnormal prothrombin and 84% are going to have thrombocytopenia. But does that mean that they have bleeding abnormalities? They may or they may not. These patients have a balanced coagulopathy. They've got some hypo and hypocoagulable states associated with this disease. And these markers, like INR and platelet counts, are not reliable indicators of their risk of bleeding. And we know that doing a paracentesis has a very low rate of complications with bleeding. So the final recommendation is that pre-procedure lab tests are not required. And we know that transfusion is associated with complications. And since they aren't associated with a reduced risk of bleeding or other complications, we don't recommend getting the lab tests.
That's a great point and really, really helpful because that question unfortunately comes up oftentimes about whether you need to routinely get coags, the PTPTT, the platelet counts, and yet the bleeding complication really is so low unless you hit a vessel. But great, that makes life a lot easier. Well, what diagnostic testing should be obtained then in these patients? And of course, if you can take us through the interpretation of the paracentesis results, that would be helpful as well. That's definitely bread and butter stuff for the boards.
Sure. One of the things that I want to point out in the paper is they state that guidelines recommend performing paracentesis in patients with clinical suspicion for SBP or in a patient with cirrhosis and ascites who's being admitted for a complication of cirrhosis. The most recent AASLD guideline that was published in 2021 actually says if they're hospitalized emergently for any reason. So any patient that's hospitalized for any reason that has ascites due to cirrhosis should have a paracentesis performed. And again, that's because this diagnosis kind of lurks underneath, and we have to be really kind of on our guard for it. So just a small point of clarification there. An early diagnosis is critical. Each hour delay in getting ascitic fluid was associated with a 3.3% increase in mortality. And that study that number came from showed that if paracentesis was performed within 12 hours, it was associated with lower in-hospital mortality and shorter length of stay compared to paracentesis performed 12 to 72 hours later. One of the things that I've encountered in the clinical area is oftentimes I'll hear, "Oh, I'm not that worried about the patient. The inpatient team will get the paracentesis. We don't need to do it in the emergency department." The problem with that is inpatient teams typically they'll consult IR. IR takes a couple of days to get it done. And we've got data now that shows that that increases their mortality. So I do think that if there's any suspicion for SBP, we should be the ones doing that procedure. In this section, they also talk about using the ultrasound in order to perform the paracentesis. And the great thing about ultrasound is, one, you can use it to find the deepest pocket, but also you can look for blood vessels in the area where you're going to stick a needle. These patients have really distended abdomens, and the blood vessels are kind of all over the place. And we know that one of the complications of liver disease is they develop things like put Medusae. So they've got blood vessels all over. And while the risk of bleeding is low, you still don't want to be the guy that sticks the needle into an artery that you didn't expect to be there. We actually did a study at University of Maryland. It was 9 years ago. It's been a while now, but we enrolled 30 patients. And what we found was, in more than half, the deepest pocket was not at one of the traditional landmark sites for paracentesis. And 43% of patients had a vessel at least one of the traditional landmark sites. So that just goes to show you that ultrasound is really important to use when doing a paracentesis, just for safety, making sure that you're going to have a successful tap and try to reduce the risk of bleeding. So the tests that they recommend sending, obviously you want to send a cell count with differential because the diagnosis of SBP is going to be made with your absolute neutrophil count of the acidic fluid. So the threshold is a ANC of greater than or equal to 250 cells per milliliter. While that's not always going to be associated with a positive culture result, they've got that lower threshold in order to not miss cases of SBP because the diagnosis is so important. At the same time you're pulling off that fluid, you want to culture the acidic fluid, but you also want to get blood cultures because that's going to increase your yield of identifying the organism. And an important note, when you are sending the culture of acidic fluid, you should inoculate the acidic fluid into blood culture bottles at the bedside with at least 10 milliliters of fluid per bottle. That's been shown to increase the sensitivity. I've been taught in the past that the average number of organisms per milliliter of acidic fluid in SBP is only one. So just one little bacteria swimming around in all that fluid. So if you think about just sending a sterile cup with a few cc's of fluid, it's no surprise that the cultures are typically negative in that. So I do bedside inoculation of blood culture bottles. I always call my lab ahead of time, let them know that I'm sending that because they get very confused when they get a blood culture bottle with acidic fluid in it. So I found that calling them ahead prevents them from throwing out the specimen and not running the culture. They also talk about getting a Gram stain. Gram stains are almost worthless for helping to identify whether somebody has SBP or identify the organism. Again, one bacteria per milliliter of fluid, so the likelihood of finding that organism underneath the microscope is pretty low. But what a Gram stain is helpful is if you've got secondary bacterial peritonitis, you'll have lots of organisms and they'll be different organisms. So if somebody had a colon perforation that's causing their bacterial peritonitis, you're going to be able to help identify that with Gram stain. They also could see food contents on the Gram stain. So another reason to send a Gram stain, even if you're not using it for the diagnosis of SBP. They have a whole section in this paper about the use of leukocyte esterase reagent strips for the rapid diagnosis of SBP. To me, I find this almost worthless. That's not how the diagnosis is made. And pretty much every place that can do a paracentesis, you can send a cell count and differential and get your results back pretty quickly. So, wasting your time with an imperfect test like a leukocyte esterase reagent strip doesn't really make sense to me. They also talk about the use of procalcitonin and CRP, which are, kind of these nonspecific markers of badness. The area under the receiver operating curve is not perfect. 0.75 for procalcitonin and CRP of greater than 3. The area under the curve is 0.55, and the combination of the two has a area under the curve of 0.76. So definitely not tests you can use to rule out SBP. So in the end, you got to do the paracentesis, and you're looking for that absolute neutrophil count of greater than or equal to 250 cells per milliliter. And I think it's also important to point out this is not the same cutoff for patients with peritoneal dialysis. It's an important distinction to make.
All right, great, great points. Those cell cutoffs always get tested on the boards, and the inoculation of the blood culture bottles. I have to admit, I don't think I ever learned that, or if I did, it's in some gyrus way at the back of my brain that doesn't usually get accessed anymore. So that's a really, really great pearl. And gosh, one bacteria per milliliter of fluid, and it's probably trying to hide from you when they look under that microscope. So the more fluid you put into those bottles, the better. That's a really fantastic pearl. Well, speaking of that one little bacteria per mil, what exactly are the organisms that we need to worry about with SBP? And with that in mind, take us through the choices of antibiotics.
Sure. So SBP is typically caused by a single type of bacteria, and traditionally that was going to be E. coli, which was present in 48 to 90% of cases. But gram-positive bacteria is becoming more common, and also infections with different multi-drug-resistant bacteria. The number of cases of multi-drug-resistant bacteria or Klebsiella, that is the causative agent of SBP, is rising, which means we need to kind of change the way we're approaching the treatment of patients with SBP. There was one study where they looked at 1,300 patients with cirrhosis, and they found that about half of the patients had community-acquired organisms, but 25% were nosocomial and another 25% were healthcare-associated. And anytime you've got nosocomial or healthcare-associated bacteria, they're going to be kind of the bad players in this, putting patients at greater risk of severe disease. So again, it's important that we make the diagnosis early, but starting antibiotics and appropriate antibiotics early is really important. Mortality increases 8 to 10% for every hour delay in antibiotics for patients in septic shock who have cirrhosis. The traditional teaching was you treat patients with a third generation cephalosporin. So you're going to give them ceftriaxone 2 grams daily or cefotaxime 2 grams every 8 hours. And that's great if you're in a location that has, local patterns of antimicrobial susceptibility that's appropriate for that. But if you're in an area that has more multi-drug resistant bacteria, or if there's risk of healthcare-associated infection, you're going to have to start thinking alternative agents. Nowadays, multi-drug resistant bacteria is present in 11 to 50% of patients with SBP. So the initial use of carbapenems may actually improve outcomes, so greater resolution of SBP and reduced mortality, especially in patients with shock, a critical illness, end organ injury, or if this is a recurrent case of SBP, or if they've been hospitalized or had antibiotics recently, you should really be thinking of expanding their coverage to be broader than just the third generation cephalosporin. You could do that with a carbapenem or using piperacillin tazobactam. And then another organism that we need to start worrying about more and more is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. If the patient's been hospitalized recently or they've had any kind of instrumentation like a previous paracentesis, you have to start thinking that this could be inoculation of skin flora into the abdomen, and MRSA could be your causative agent. So you may consider adding vancomycin or linezolid.
Once again, some great points. Well, the final question that the authors posed related to blood products, and we've touched on blood products before, but what about albumin? Does that have a role in patients with SBP? I've seen some of the GI docs who get consulted for the sicker patients come down, and it seems to almost be a flip of a coin, at least in my mind, from what I've seen. But I'm sure there's got to be some rhyme or reason to it. So, which patients need albumin? Do any patients need albumin? Take us through that, Gentry.
Sure. Albumin is one of those things that's been tried in a lot of disease states, just generalized sepsis, things like that. And it really hasn't panned out to be that effective. But this is one of the cases where albumin is really important. So in patients that have SBP and develop acute kidney injury, they're going to have increased mortality. So the idea behind giving albumin is you're going to increase their volume, which prevents that development of acute kidney injury and preventing patient mortality and morbidity. One meta-analysis found that the administration of albumin intravenously was associated with a 22.3% absolute reduction in risk of developing renal impairment. So your number needed to treat was 5, and the reduction in mortality was 19.4%. So the number needed to treat was 6. So albumin's definitely got a place in the treatment of SBP. The guidelines recommend giving it at 1.5 grams per kilogram on day one, and then 48 hours an additional dose of 1 gram per kilogram is given. Now, in this paper, in the article that we're reviewing, they say that guidelines recommend administering albumin in a specific patient population. They talk about a bilirubin greater than 4, creatinine greater than 1, or BUN greater than 30. The AASLD guidelines, which I mentioned before, and those are really the guidelines that focus on this, they don't exactly say that you want to restrict it to those, but they do state that patients who benefited most had those characteristics. I personally give albumin in any patient with spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. The evidence behind that restrictive use of albumin came from one paper that was published in 2006. It was a very short research paper, only 6 paragraphs long, so not a lot of details, but it was prospective and enrolled 36 patients. I'd really love to see some more evidence on this topic, but for now, I'm not restricting the use of albumin personally. All patients with SBP get it that I've diagnosed.
That's really interesting. All right. Yeah, I haven't seen that practice amongst most people, but you make a really strong argument to be more liberal about using albumin. So really interesting. Well, that was a really helpful discussion. There was, as I mentioned at the start, really a lot of things that I thought maybe I knew, but I really didn't. And maybe some things that I relearned that maybe at some point in the past I learned. Do you have any final take-home points or really critical things that you want to leave with the listeners as we finish up?
Yeah, I think the final points are you've got to be thinking about spontaneous bacterial peritonitis in patients with ascites, cirrhosis and ascites. You've got to think about the diagnosis. And if you're at all suspicious that they may have it, if they've got any of those risk factors, abdominal pain, fever, hypothermia, altered mental status especially, then you've got to do a paracentesis. You can't wait for the inpatient team to do it. Delays in diagnosis really increase morbidity and mortality. And then think about, the different tests you're going to send and how you're going to treat them. And be aware that broader coverage is really important these days in patients that are sick and have risk factors for organisms other than E. coli being the cause of their SBP.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Gentry Wilkerson, thank you so much for joining us today for EMCast. It's always great to talk to you and very enlightening. And hope to get you back again on EMCast if you can find some time in your very busy schedule. So, Gentry, once again, thanks so much.
Thank you, Amal. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, one of the things that we've typically tried to do with EMCast is to keep up to date on important clinical guidelines and clinical policies from national organizations that relate directly to emergency medicine.
ACEP, the American College of Emergency Physicians, just published a clinical policy on severe agitation January 2024. Specifically, the full title of the article was Critical Issues in the Evaluation and Management of Adult Out-of-Hospital or Emergency Department Patients Presenting with Severe Agitation. It's a long, long title, but again, I'm just going to call it severe agitation. What do we do? This was published, again, very recently, and we've kind of talked about some of these concepts in the past, but whenever ACEP publishes a clinical policy, I always like discussing it because they present typically very useful information, very cutting edge and to the point information. And also, these articles often show up in the ABEM LLSA, which is the article list for maintaining board certification. So it's nice to get a jump on these for the listeners. Well, one of my colleagues who's been on the EMCast before, Dr. Dan Gingell, sent this article to me, and it's an area of personal interest to him. He's lectured probably on EMCast on related topics before. And so I'm going to ask him to discuss some of the key points in this article. So, first of all, Dan, welcome back to the EMCast. It's great to have you back.
Great. Thanks for having me, Amal. Excited to be here.
Well, now, usually these clinical policies present several questions, and then following the question, they present the evidence to those questions, and then they kind of rank what the level of evidence is, and so on. But this is a little bit different because in this clinical policy, they only ask one question, and that question is there a superior parenteral medication or combination of medications for the acute management of adult out-of-hospital or emergency department patients with severe agitation? So one key question, and there's really a lot of stuff to discuss, even though it is just one question. And they present some summary comments about each of the various choices of medications. And so what we're going to do is we're going to review those various choices. So let's go ahead and jump right in. Now, they start by discussing the groups of antipsychotics, benzodiazepines, and combinations of these. And it kind of makes sense to group this discussion because what we and so many other people have done over the years is to combine the medications. For example, we have the classic, what we refer to as the B52, the Benadryl, which is diphenhydramine for those international listeners. And then the 52 refers to 5 milligrams of haloperidol and 2 milligrams of lorazepam. And people have various other combinations, but B52 has a nice ring to it. So we love that. Anyway, what do we need to know about these groups of medications, Dan?
Yeah, I think it's like you said, worth just understanding what the options are before we get to pick the best one. I really like this clinical policy because it really just asks the question everybody wants to know. Like get rid of all the choices and finesse. Just tell me what to do. Tell me what is the best medicine. So of course, like you said, there's two big groups of medications we use for sedation and agitated patients. The first is antipsychotics. And the thing to remember about antipsychotics is they are good for psychosis, obviously. So people who are hallucinating or having paranoia from any cause, but especially a primary psychiatric cause. They're also great for medical-related delirium and alcohol intoxication. And the antipsychotics typically are broken up into the first generation, the older ones, haloperidol and droperidol, and then second generation or newer atypical antipsychotics, olanzapine, zuprasidone, quetiapine. Those are kind of the most common ones. I think we see in the ED. Risperidone is also available, but that's only available PO, so not really as useful for acute agitation. And what the guideline says here that if you're using a single agent for whatever reason, choose an antipsychotic. That is better. And they recommend using droperidol or second generation antipsychotic like olanzapine. It does mention that haloperidol works. It works fine. It's tried and true. It's efficacious, as the guideline says, but we want rapid and efficacious. And it mentions that droperidol is not just efficacious, but it's faster. And a word on droperidol safety, this was actually covered in another clinical guideline, but it's reiterated here. Droperidol is safe. It had a black box warning for QT prolongation for many years. It's actually not based on very good evidence. It's much stronger, high quality evidence that it's no worse than any other medication that we use for sedation with regards to QT prolongation. So, and in addition, it has a lot of benefits compared to our other agents. It's faster onset, you have less repeat dosing, less respiratory depression than other antipsychotics. And again, no difference at all in cardiac events or QTC prolongation. You do not need an EKG before you administer it. That's often difficult to do, and it's a fairly agitated patient. Just give it, especially IM, doses under 5 milligrams, you can give IV, although some studies in this review actually did use 10 milligrams IV, which I think gave our ED pharmacist the willies. but if you're using it IM, really no, especially for one or two doses, not a lot of concern for QT prolongation. So that's the antipsychotics. Then there's the benzodiazepine. Benzos, also great drugs. Long track record of safety and efficacy. They're particularly good if someone is anxious, if they have a sympathomimetic toxidrome, or if they're withdrawing from alcohol or benzodiazepines. And the common ones we use sort of in order of speed are midazolam, lorazepam, and diazepam. They all work. They all can be given IM. Midazolam is clearly the fastest on, but that also is the fastest off. It has a shortest duration of action. Diazepam takes the longest to act, but has the longest duration of action. And then lorazepam is sort of in the middle. And again, we can sometimes use alprazolam for panic attacks, but that's only in PO formulas. There has been a lot of work looking at, and the research that's cited in the clinical policy, looking at use of midazolam as a single agent for severe agitation. And I think a big takeaway point from this clinical policy is the pendulum is really swinging away from using benzos, in particular midazolam, as a single agent in severe agitation. I think if the person's having withdrawal, obviously benzos alone are fine. If there's some anxiety or not severe agitation, maybe single agent benzos are okay. But in severe agitation, single dose midazolam actually had more adverse events compared to combination drugs or antipsychotics, and that included respiratory depression. And they also needed more redosing. So I think if you have to pick a single agent in the adult patient with severe agitation, really want to go with the antipsychotic, and in particular, droperidol.
Great. Yeah, we love droperidol when it's around. Unfortunately, oftentimes there are national shortages or local shortages. I suspect somebody probably has a big store at home somewhere. And so that's why we can never get it. But it's a really great drug. And it's always interesting about the sordid drug company story about how droperidol ended up with the black box warning when the drug company bought out the manufacturing of droperidol and then reported on themselves so people would stop using droperidol and use a more expensive drug. But anyway, I digress. Now you mentioned that essentially either the antipsychotic or the benzo can be used alone with pretty good effects. Midazolam and other benzos have some concerning side effects that we've learned about. What about using them in combination? Why is the combination preferred oftentimes?
Yeah, the combos are great. You mentioned our tried and true, B52. I mean, if one is good, two must be better. Why choose? Sometimes you can get the best of both worlds, especially if you're not really sure why the patient is agitated. They also might be agitated for multiple reasons. They could be very anxious, which would be good with benzos because they're paranoid, which would respond to antipsychotics. Or they could be hallucinating, which would respond to antipsychotics because a bunch of drugs they've taken, like cocaine or, synthetic cannabinoid or something like that, which would respond well to the benzo. So often in these situations, we'd like to address multiple issues. We also want the person in a severe agitation to get agitated quickly. So it's possible that using two drugs would be faster. And indeed, that's what the recommendation from the clinical policy supports. So it mentioned haloperidol and lorazepam are classic part of our B52. This works fine. It's labeled as efficacious, but it's just not as fast acting as droperidol and midazolam. So the clinical policy has a level B recommendation for rapid and efficacious treatment of severe agitation in the emergency department, use a combination of droperidol and midazolam. It's likely the most effective agent to treat severe agitation because it has improved time to sedation and better side effect profile compared to the single agents. So it really is focusing on using the combination of droperidol and midazolam as first line over even single agent antipsychotics like droperidol alone, and again recommends avoiding midazolam as a single agent in severe agitation.
Sure. Now, a lot of times people will add diphenhydramine or the brand name Benadryl, which is where the B52 comes from. What are your thoughts about routinely adding Benadryl to this combination? Is that something that you do?
It's not something I do very commonly. This is not addressed in the guideline, I think mostly because we don't really have good enough evidence to, say it's a good idea or a bad idea. It's probably not necessary. EPS, the theory behind adding the Benadryl is that it'll prevent extrapyramidal side effects through EPS reaction. Those are relatively rare and can be treated after the fact. There is some evidence to show that diphenhydramine with the haloperidol and lorazepam has been associated with prolonged sedation as well, which, if it's just someone who's intoxicated with alcohol, just needs to take a short nap and wake up and sober and go home, that might prolong the person's length of stay unnecessarily. But something I learned from my psychiatric colleagues is that the concern about the EPS actually makes the droperidol-midazolam combo more appealing. Benzos are also used to prevent EPS and get a little bit of that dopamine action. So by including the benzo, you're already dealing with that problem that the Benadryl or the diphenhydramine is supposed to be addressing. So the diphenhydramine is really not necessary. This isn't really in the clinical policy either, but my personal opinion about the single versus dual agent, I can address that too. The policy
Sure.
says if you must use a single agent, use droperidol. And sometimes it is, like you said, just down to what you have available, what you have on hand. And I'd say in general, like run-of-the-mill agitation, it's nice to match the cause of the treatment. If someone's anxious or has cocaine on board, benzos are good for that. And if they have primary psychosis or alcohol intoxication, you give the antipsychotics. So if it's a BYOB situation, they're drunk and agitated, you only really need the antipsychotic because they brought their own benzo with them. And droperidol is great. Withholding the midazolam can avoid the possible negative synergy with benzodiazepine for respiratory depression. You're covered for the EPS associated with the droperidol with alcohol. And like we said before, there's no real need for the diphenhydramine. So that's kind of nice to just give one agent. But if you don't know what's going on, especially when the agitation is really severe, which is the focus of this clinical policy, going dual agent makes a lot of sense. And to get that faster onset, less redosing, mitigate EPS side effects, you can go with the droperidol and the midazolam.
Got it. That does make a lot of sense. A lot of people will add the diphenhydramine, but I haven't really read a whole lot either about why there's any benefit to it because the extrapyramidal side effects are relatively rare. Well, the authors then change gears a little bit and they focus on a drug that we in emergency medicine absolutely love, but it also has had kind of a controversial history, especially during recent years, and that is ketamine. So, what are the key points about ketamine that ACEP wants us to know about and that you want us to know about?
Yeah, so the clinical policy gives a level C recommendation regarding the use of ketamine in the severely agitated patient. I think it's an expert and consensus recommendation just because of the quality of literature that's available. We have a large body of evidence that ketamine is safe and effective for other uses in the ED. Most of us are very familiar with using it for procedural sedation or induction for intubation, obviously. There's very extensive literature about its safety and efficacy in that point, but there's just less literature focusing on its use in severe agitation in particular. So the clinical policy recommends that in situations where safety of the patient, bystanders, or staff is a concern, consider using ketamine, IV or IM, to rapidly treat severe agitation. And that's because ketamine is really effective and really fast acting. So it's even faster onset, 2 to 10 minutes IM, less than 2 minutes IV if you do have an IV. So it's faster onset than even droperidol, and it's much more consistent, especially used at doses at IM, especially given IM compared to antipsychotics given IM. You have to give a rather large dose IM, like 4 to 6 milligrams per kilogram, but it's very reliable in achieving rapid sedation, and there's much less need for additional medications. So I think that's why the experts who made the guideline are really recommending in a situation where safety is a concern, the person has to be controlled very, very quickly, recommending using ketamine. You referenced some controversy. I mean, ketamine is a very safe drug. The nice thing about it is it tends to not impact people's airway. It tends to not impact people's respiratory drive. But that does happen every once in a while, especially in agitated patients where you don't know what else, what other substances might be on board. You know, it's possible that those events are a little bit higher. But looking at some of the studies quoted in the literature review, deaths that are directly attributable to ketamine are actually like vanishingly rare. A lot of the deaths that have been associated around ketamine, where ketamine was used and someone died, it's not the ketamine. It's the chokehold. It's the lack of appropriate airway monitoring. It's other substances that are involved, other medical problems that are going on that lead to the person's death. It really does not seem to be ketamine. Ketamine really seems like a safe drug. So while we don't have excellent high quality evidence to support ketamine for the use of severe agitation in the ED, we, because of the safety in other contexts, we think that it's reasonable in this choice. And, but, you know, because the, in the, that's why they gave a level C recommendation. And that's why they're limiting the strong recommendation to when safety is concerned, because if safety is concerned, the benefits of the rapid and effective controlling of the patient, you know, outweigh any possible increase in adverse effects. But it is really important that when we're using ketamine, to treat it like procedural sedation in terms of monitor. So that's definitely not the patient that you can just, you know, put them down with ketamine and walk away. They need to have cardiac monitor, pulse ox monitor, and tidal CO2. And we really should be using ketamine as a bridge to another therapy, right? So, you know, give them IM ketamine, get control of the situation, monitor them, get a line, and then we can give them additional medications. Because remember, ketamine also wears off relatively quickly, you know, 20 to 30 minutes. We're going to want something, another agent on board before the ketamine goes away.
Absolutely agree. Ketamine has just such a tremendous therapeutic window and safety profile. Again, unfortunately, we've had some national shortages recently, but hopefully it will become more available once again, because it really is a great drug, just like you said, when rapid control is necessary. Okay. Well, aside from what we talked about so far, are there any other agents that we should know about and possibly use?
Well, I mentioned the diphenhydramine. The policy also touches on a few things that I've actually never used, some studies on sodium valproate, as well as combining promethazine with haloperidol as opposed to diphenhydramine with haloperidol. I think giving the short answer here is that these things work okay, but if you have the agents that we already talked about, I'm not really sure there's much benefit in using them. There's more data to support the ones we've already discussed. That doesn't really seem to add very much unless for some reason, you know, you don't have them available. And just a reminder that if the patient's not having agitation that's severe, but, you know, seeming a little anxious, maybe agitating, maybe you're worried that they might become agitated, we can always offer PO meds. We talked about alprazolam, great for panic attacks. Risperidone is a good sort of general medicine for psychosis if they're not on something else otherwise. Some places also have olanzapine in a sublingual formulation, like a dissolving strip. That's a really nice in between. It works a little faster than the PO olanzapine, but it avoids needles, obviously, and it avoids pill swallowing. So sometimes patients who are a little agitated or confused can still tolerate that. And it's a really nice way to get that medication on board. You can also use hydroxyzine and diphenhydramine for mild anxiety, but for really severe agitation, you know, they're probably not going to want to cut it. We're going to want to go with that droperidol and midazolam, like we discussed before.
Great points. And again, this paper was all about severe agitation, but it's important to remember that there are milder forms. And you've talked about them in previous EMCasts, about things like verbal de-escalation if it's really mild, and then stepping up to oral. And then, of course, if it is really severe, going to the parenteral route. Well, that was a really great discussion and recap of a handful of things and some new points on some of these medications. Do you have any final take-home points or pearls for the listeners that you want to leave people with?
Yeah, just as a reminder, the clinical policy, as you said, was focusing on treatment of severe agitation of adults in the ED. So it's not addressing pediatrics. It's also not addressing older adults, patients above 65. And it did not, even though it was in the question, it didn't address pre-hospital or out-of-hospital settings. So those are patient populations and clinical settings that the work group, I think, did not feel like they had enough quality evidence to make a consensus recommendation. And so we're going to be looking out for more information and guidance in those populations in the future. As for take-home points, like you mentioned, the ACIP also reiterated this in the policy that trying verbal de-escalation and offering oral meds and choices is always a good option. And then if you have to escalate, going the parental route. It's difficult overall. You know, the question, as I mentioned, is the one we want to know. And it's difficult to parse through their literature which is the single best agent or combination, because there's so many different study designs, comparison groups, doses. Every study compares a different amount of something, or, you know, multiple, if they have multiple drug arms, they choose different drugs to compare. So it's a little bit hard to tease out exactly what agent and what dose is best for all comers. In some ways, it depends, as we talked about. But I think the big take-home points from the clinical policy that are practice-changing are: for rapid and efficacious treatment of the severe agitation, use that droperidol and midazolam combination, starting with 5 milligrams. 5 milligrams is a good starting dose. If for some reason using a single agent is preferred, choose droperidol or a second generation antipsychotic like olanzapine. And when safety is a concern, using ketamine 4 to 6 milligrams per kilogram IM with appropriate monitoring for safety as a bridge to longer lasting therapy is recommended.
All right, fantastic. Well, Dan, thanks so much for walking us through this clinical policy. I'm sure it's going to end up on the LLSA and the boards. And there's some really nice information that was not necessarily common knowledge. So this is going to be really, really helpful. Hope to get you back again to talk about some other topics of interest. And
absolutely.
Again, thanks so much for your time.
No, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, next up on EMCast, we're going to spend some time talking about geriatric trauma. There was an article that was published by the American College of Surgeons Trauma Program's Best Practice Guidelines recently pertaining to geriatric trauma. This article actually was given to me by one of my colleagues that you've heard many times before, Rob Flint. And Rob has, as you probably know by now, has definitely developed an academic niche in trauma care, but he also has an interest in elder care as well. And no surprise, Rob is currently the associate chief at our VA hospital. And that's always been a great geriatric and elder care type of experience for the residents. Although I have to say that the vets are getting younger and younger over the years. But anyway, this kind of combines two of his areas of interest. So first of all, Rob, thanks for joining us and sending me this article. Tell us a little bit about how you found this article and why you would like to discuss it.
Yeah, thanks, Amal. It's great to be back with the audience. I found this article. I'm always looking for trauma articles, obviously. And the American College of Surgeons puts out a variety of different best practices. So I always scan through those to see what they have. And this really jumped out as a well-written program. So I think we're going to have a really nice topic here to discuss on older patients and the trauma and how it's different from maybe your typical young gunshot victim.
Well, this was clearly a multidisciplinary type of article focused on a multidisciplinary type of audience. So as usual, we're going to focus in on what we in the emergency department need to know. And for those people out there in acute care, we'll focus a bit more on that. First of all, tell us, why should we be interested in this topic in the first place?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So looking at this topic is important for emergency providers and acute care providers because the number of older patients we see is proportionally going up. And this paper particularly looks at traumatic injuries in older patients, which they define as over 65 years. And that number of trauma patients is increased both by number as well as the proportion of patients seen at trauma centers and emergency departments. Unintentional injury is the seventh leading cause of death in older patients. And we know that outcomes are worse for older trauma patients compared to younger patients, and that older age is an independent risk factor for mortality.
All right. What do we know about this fact that age is an independent risk factor for mortality in older patients?
So independent of mechanism of injury, age alone is a significant risk factor for mortality. So I think a better way to look at this is frailty. Those patients with a high frailty score, high degree of frailty, have a much higher level of mortality. So I think as clinicians, it's better for us to start thinking not only of age, but also of frailty as we address these patients and look at their risk factors and their mortality. And I really think that can help us guide treatment and help predict the need for resource utilization.
Well, a lot of the papers that you see in the literature pertaining to elderly patients talk about this concept of frailty
not just pertaining to trauma, but pertaining to post-cardiac care and infectious disease and just about everything. Can you just talk to us a little bit about what exactly is frailty and also this frailty index that they talk about?
Yeah, frailty and the frailty index look at a patient in terms of their physiologic state, not their age. It takes into account comorbid conditions such as cancer history, coronary artery disease, and dementia. It also incorporates the ability to do activities of daily living, such as independent grooming and toileting, ability to do housework, manage their money, and the need for mobility assist devices. A higher score in the frailty index is a better predictor of trauma mortality than age alone. Early on in our assessment of these elder trauma patients, we should be gathering data to assess for frailty, as it's going to impact our decisions and the decisions of our consultants.
Now, let's get into some of the trauma issues specifically. What type of injury patterns do we tend to see in older adults?
Falls are the most common type of injury in older adults, and we're talking about falls from standing. This also is the mechanism that leads to the most fatal injuries. We need to have a high index of suspicion in older patients with what may sound like an average fall. Older patients are less able to protect themselves when they fall, thus leading to more head injury, more torso injuries. They're less able to adjust as they fall, and they also have less mobility as they're falling. And they also have, obviously, bone indexes that are different, and they tend to have less of the ability, muscle mass, to absorb some of the fall that they're experiencing. And the risk factors for falls include living alone, using more than 6 medications, use of ambulatory aids like walkers, and those that have depression, cognitive decline, and if you've had a previous fall. So falling once doubles your chances of a future fall. When we see a fall patient in the ED, it's our chance to intervene and really prevent future mortality and morbidity and really address the home situation and the reason behind the fall.
Yeah, definitely great points. And some of those risk factors that you see are so prevalent amongst all of the elderly patients we see in the emergency department. All right, so we know that falls are a large cause of serious traumatic injury in older patients. Are there other mechanisms that we should know about also?
Yeah, motor vehicle crashes are the second leading cause of traumatic injuries in older patients. Older patients are staying active longer, more mobile, so we see a higher number of motor vehicle crashes. And risk factors for having these crashes are cognitive decline, female sex, and decline of visual acuity. There's also an increased risk for older patients to be struck as pedestrians due to their slightly slower walking speed and that vision acuity that we talked about. Even seemingly minor crashes can lead to high mortality rates in patients with a high fragility index score. And then rounding out the causes of traumatic injury are burns. Older patients actually make up 20% of burn center admissions. And unfortunately, we also should talk about suicide in older patients because it's a high percentage within that population. We should be screening for elder abuse, just as we do for pediatric patients, and know that a lot of elder abuse is associated with family members or close associates.
All right, great points. Well, now that we have kind of a handle on some of the epidemiology, let's talk a little bit about how to manage these patients. So first of all, if you're working out at a community hospital and you're trying to decide whether to keep this patient and manage them yourself or transfer them, how do you make that decision? Who is it that you would recommend should be transferred to a trauma center versus just keeping them at your emergency department out in the community?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have to think about older patients having different physiology than younger patients. So this paper actually suggests we adjust our guidelines for who should be sent to a trauma center versus who should be seen in a regular ED. And what they suggest is age over 65, anyone with a heart rate over 90 in that age range instead of the typical 120, and adjusting systolic blood pressure to under 110 or a shock index over 1. So any of those physiologic parameters being adjusted really should trigger a trauma activation. They also suggest a ground level fall on anticoagulation or any ground level fall with signs of head injury or an altered mental status really should be seen at a trauma center versus a standard emergency department.
Got it. All right. Now, as we approach these patients, we've all learned about the basic ABC. Is there anything different or anything particularly specific to older patients that we should keep in mind?
I do think when we assess these patients, what we do in the ED is going to set them on their course throughout the rest of their hospital stay. So I think first, just having a high index of suspicion for injury with these patients is really important. Low impact injuries that typically wouldn't cause significant injury are things we have to worry about in older patients. So we do our assessment, we look for frailty, and we identify those with higher chance of occult injury. And this is going to allow us to identify those with a higher risk of morbidity and mortality going forward. And I think most important, we use a slow, gentle approach to the evaluation. We can't take their glasses away and their hearing aids away and expect them to be able to communicate with us. It also increases confusion and worsens cognitive factor when you start stripping them of their ability to process their environment. So I think we have to take our time, let them answer our questions. And really, this is someone you just have to go very slow, meticulously, and make sure that you're not cutting any corners.
Okay, well, let's get into just a little bit more specifics about those ABCs. With elderly patients, are there any specific airway issues that we should keep in mind when compared to younger patients?
Yes, there can be more redundant neck tissue. They may have spine arthritis, temporal mandibular joint disease, poor dentition. And there tends to be a higher chance of airway collapse and friability in older patients. All of this we should anticipate as we prepare for our intubation. So I think having a good backup plan for your intubation and knowing that you can use an LMA in these patients very successfully as your rescue airway device may be important information for you to have as you approach the airway. The article also suggests dosage adjustments for common RSI drugs, such as decreasing etomidate to 0.1 to 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. And as we talk about with every elder conversation, we should be decreasing our opiate medication dosing and really trying to avoid benzos if possible. But if you have to use them, drop them by 20 to 40% of your typical dosing. And the mantra of when in doubt, start low and go slow, I think really does apply to the elder patient when we're looking at RSI drugs and any medications.
Great. Okay, so that's the A. What about the B and the C, breathing and circulation? Any special things to keep in mind as we're approaching the resuscitation?
Yeah, a couple small points. When you put these patients on a ventilator, remember to go with low volumes and pressures. This has been shown to really dramatically improve outcomes. Hyperventilation leads to worse outcomes. As far as circulation, remember these patients may not develop tachycardia, whether that's because of their underlying physiology or because of underlying medications that they're on. So don't rely on tachycardia as your source to evaluate for hypovolemia. We talked about adjusting down that systolic blood pressure to 110, but we also talked about adjusting the heart rate down to 90 as a trigger for trauma activation. So just be wary that tachycardia may not develop in these patients, and they can be significantly hypovolemic without having a lot of the other signs that we typically rely on.
All right, great points. Now, in terms of blood transfusions, do we just follow the standard protocols? Can we give older patients large volumes of blood and mass transfusion pathways, or do we have to change that up also?
Oh, we should absolutely stick to the mass transfusion protocols. I think that is really an important part that comes out of this article. Patients do better with blood products than they do saline. We know that. And we know that appropriately transfusing patients leads to better outcomes. And that is 100% true still in geriatric patients. Don't worry about fluid overload. Don't worry about cardiac output in these patients. Start with your appropriate resuscitation. Now, there does appear to be a ceiling for the amount of volume that you can give. So an octogenarian who received 2 units of packed red cells had a 28% mortality compared to an 80% mortality at 10 units. And some of that's the volume, but some of it's also the degree of physiologic derangement that's going on there. Using injury patterns as well as frailty index can help us decide when to continue transfusion and decide when it's futile. So I think it's really important to gather that data early and decide when to turn off these pathways as well. That's something we're not necessarily as good at. We need to decide when is further transfusion futile and are we wasting product that we may be able to use on other patients. So we should always be looking for non-hemorrhagic causes of shock in these patients as well. Just keep in mind, obviously, underlying coronary artery disease, so myocardial ischemia or infarction could be prevalent. Look for the medication-induced hypotension. And don't forget to look for spinal cord injuries, et cetera, as well.
All right. So that kind of takes care of the primary survey. What about the secondary survey and the subsequent workup? What do we do similarly or differently?
I think we have to remember that these patients are more difficult to assess, and they are much more likely to have occult injury. So you have to be liberal with your use of imaging and lab work. You know, regular reassessments of the patient is critical. Look for altered mental status, vital sign changes, or any new complaints that may change. So these are patients that we just need to check on regularly and be a little more liberal in the use of our adjunct studies.
Got it. So these are definitely not patients that we're trying to be cost effective with. if there's any group of patients that you're going to shotgun a little with, then it makes sense to do that with the elderly patients, especially when patients have mental status changes. And that leads me to the next question. A lot of elderly patients will have mental status changes, even with minor mechanisms of illness or injury. And then you end up in that whole box about trying to distinguish delirium versus dementia. Do you have any pearls for us in that distinction?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think we have to look at who has underlying dementia versus is this acute change. So keep in mind, patients are more likely to develop delirium as age advances. Males are more likely to develop delirium. And then other risk factors are medication sensitivity, benzodiazepines and opiates, and that sensory deprivation we talked about, such as taking away glasses and hearing aids, their physiologic derangement, and pre-existing cognitive impairment all lead to a higher prevalence of delirium. So delirium can be both hyperactive and hypoactive. So if they're very agitated, we certainly need to think about head injury, hypovolemia, but it also could be their delirium coming out as a sign for these other underlying symptoms. So don't assume that confusion is their baseline. Don't assume that confusion is just because they're old. This could be a new underlying illness coming through for us. So getting their baseline is critical, and being vigilant, looking for underlying causes is really the most important take-home point for that.
Definitely great points. Yeah, that delirium versus dementia thing oftentimes is so difficult. And I recall other papers and studies in the elderly patients that have talked about just how frequently we as healthcare providers, not just emergency medicine, but everybody, when taking care of acute illnesses, we tend to overdiagnose and overattribute acute delirium to dementia. And that can have a really bad outcome, because delirium really does need to be treated and aggressively worked up and treated well. So it's something to definitely be on the lookout for. Well, that was a really great discussion of this paper. Rob, any final take-home points or pearls that you want to leave with the listeners?
Yeah, I think as emergency providers, we're just going to see more older patients, and we're going to see more older trauma patients in the coming years. So working with our EMS colleagues and our trauma colleagues to create the trauma protocols is certainly going to be important. And I think your point about looking at delirium is really, really important. We need to assume that this is delirium until proven otherwise, and look for that underlying cause. So if we're taking care of older patients, be patient, take your time, go slow, adjust your medications, and really be vigilant in looking for underlying disease.
All right, fantastic. Once again, this article was put out by the American College of Surgeons Trauma Programs, and it's called Best Practices Guidelines, Geriatric Trauma Management. It was put out in November 2023. Rob, thanks so much for bringing this to our attention. And also, as I'm looking at this article, looks like it's about 90 pages. So I really appreciate you summarizing this 90-page epic novel here for all of us and keeping it relevant. So, Rob, once again, thanks so much. And I look forward to talking to you again really soon.
Thanks, Amal. My pleasure.
All right, folks, it's time for our summary, and we kick things off with a discussion of spontaneous bacterial peritonitis with Dr. Gentry Wilkerson. And just when you think you know everything about a certain condition, or at least what's important about a certain condition, a paper comes along and opens your eyes to certain points, and that was definitely true for SBP. Some of the background stats were interesting to me. First of all, infections account for anywhere from 25 to 50% of the reason liver patients end up being admitted, liver failure patients. And the most common infection that they get is SBP. That's not so much of a surprise, but about 30% of the time, SBP is the infection that we need to deal with. Mortality is increased fourfold when they have any type of infection, including SBP, and survival significantly drops. And one of the other stats that was interesting, 5 to 30% of patients with ascites admitted to the hospital for any reason have SBP. So it's a strong push to do the paracentesis in the emergency department whenever possible. It's not always possible, especially if the amount of fluid is relatively small and the place is going crazy. But when you have an opportunity to do the paracentesis, if you have a good pocket of fluid, go ahead and get it done. Gentry reviewed some of the statistics associated with an increase in mortality when the diagnosis is delayed. So when possible, when reasonable, when feasible, go ahead and do the paracentesis. That obviously is not going to be every single time, but whenever possible. When should you suspect SBP? Well, the classic presentation is abdominal pain or tenderness and or fever and or altered mental status in a patient who has chronic liver disease and has evidence of ascites either on exam or based on ultrasound. And those are the things that you want to look for. Again, Gentry made the argument that anybody with severe liver disease who's being admitted who happens to have ascites is probably worth going ahead and doing the paracentesis. And I would counter that by saying, of course, it's going to depend on whether you have the time and availability and if the paracentesis can be done with a large pocket of fluid. We see a lot of patients in our emergency department who have liver disease, and I got to admit that even with ultrasound, very, very adept residents and faculty at ultrasound, sometimes those pockets of fluid are not that large, and we end up having to get interventional radiology to drain the fluid. So it's not always as easy as it sounds. But when the patient has tense ascites, it's definitely worth getting that tap and finding out if they have an infection or not. One of the other questions that oftentimes comes up is, do you need to get the PT, PTT, and the INR and the platelet count before doing the paracentesis? And the literature would suggest that the answer is no, that you don't need routine lab testing before doing the paracentesis, because this is simply not a procedure which produces significant bleeding to the point of requiring transfusion. Now, you can use your own gestalt with that statement, but the literature would suggest that routine lab testing is not something that needs to be done. What about the results? The key thing that you're looking for, an absolute neutrophil count greater than 250 cells per milliliter, and that's going to be your indication that the patient does in fact have an infection. What are the bugs that you're worried about? Well, as usual with the belly, you're worried about E. coli and other gram-negative enteric type of bacteria. There is an increase in multi-drug resistant bugs and also Klebsiella. So based on maybe prior cultures, you might decide how far to expand your coverage. We'll typically start out with the third generation cephalosporin. That's usually going to be adequate, but do check prior paracentesis results to see if you might need expanded coverage. And then the other question that comes up oftentimes is, when do you need to use albumin? And the paper didn't go into this in detail, but Dr. Wilkerson made the strong point that patients with SBP who also have acute kidney injury will oftentimes benefit from getting some albumin. And in those patients, it's been shown to decrease mortality. And he said that you should consider giving albumin in patients with bilirubins over 4, creatinines over 1, and BUNs over 30. So again, key thing, combination of kidney injury plus liver injury. Those are the patients in whom you really ought to consider giving albumin. And if you're not comfortable with that, then it's probably worth discussing that with your GI specialist. Well, next, we switched over and talked about the recently published ACEP clinical policy, critical issues in the evaluation and management of adult out-of-hospital or emergency department patients presenting with severe agitation. We'll just call it the policy on severe agitation from ACEP. And it was a nice review of some things that we've talked about before, but also brought to the forefront some important new concepts also. And Dr. Dan Gingold, one of my colleagues who loves this topic, took us through this paper. So just a quick recap. We talked about different groups of medications. The first was antipsychotics, which probably ought to be thought of as the first-line agents for most patients. First-generation antipsychotics include tried and true drugs like haloperidol and droperidol. Second generation, or sometimes referred to as atypical antipsychotics, include olanzapine, ziprasidone, and quetiapine. The first generation
tend to work a little bit faster and more successful, especially droperidol. We love using droperidol intermittently. There tends to be national shortages, but it works very nicely. It's quick. It can be given intramuscularly. And the whole QT prolongation thing, I think, largely has been debunked at the typical doses we use. If you're going to use whopping doses, then you might run into some QT prolongation issues. But with standard dosages, it's really not so much of an issue. And as a result, there's no real need for EKG monitoring or testing before giving it. After all, if somebody's agitated, you're not going to get a good EKG on those patients anyway. Benzodiazepines have a long history. And when I was in residency, that was definitely the first line agent that we would go to. But literature over the years has shown that benzos are probably best for alcohol withdrawal or benzodiazepine withdrawal. But as a first line agent for undifferentiated agitation, probably not that great because they are associated with more adverse events, and also they're associated with more requirements for redosing. Now, if you are going to use these, they can be given intramuscularly, especially midazolam, which tends to be the best when given intramuscularly. And they probably work a little bit better when used in combination with other drugs. After all, oftentimes agitation is multifactorial, so getting some benzos on board if there's some type of drug withdrawal is great, but adding some antipsychotics, for example, the combination of midazolam plus haloperidol or midazolam plus droperidol often is a very, very nice combination. Both can be given intramuscularly and tend to work fairly quickly. Ketamine in recent years has emerged as a very popular drug for severe agitation, and consensus guidelines say you probably ought to consider using ketamine when patient or staff safety is a major issue, but it can sometimes be a little bit of a more concerning drug or a higher maintenance drug. And maybe that's because of national headlines that have talked about patients that have had adverse outcomes in the pre-hospital arena when given ketamine. Now, in reality, generally deaths associated with ketamine are typically not related to the ketamine itself, but probably related to other substances that are on board or inappropriate monitoring or inappropriate physical restraint and so on. Key thing here is that if you're going to use ketamine, make absolutely positively unquestionably certain that you are monitoring the patient just the way you would for anybody who's getting procedural sedation. So stay on top of those patients. It's not a panacea where you can just give a quick shot of ketamine and then everything's good. You've got to monitor those patients very quickly. So just some take-home points from this section. Again, you always, of course, want to try verbal de-escalation first and try oral medications when you need to use medications. But if the patient is just not there and just not cooperative with the verbal or the oral medications, then go ahead and use, probably a first line thought would be combination droperidol and midazolam or some type of combination. And in times of danger to the patient or the staff, that's really when you're going to go ahead and use ketamine and monitor those patients very, very closely. And last but not least, we spent some time talking with Dr. Robert Flint about geriatric trauma. He reviews some key things that we need to know about taking care of the elder trauma patient from recent trauma programs' best practice guidelines. And a lot of this relates to what we probably ought to know and have learned about care of the elderly patient in general. But just some quick things to keep in mind. Number one, as the number of elderly patients is increasing in the emergency department, so too are the number of elderly trauma patients showing up in the emergency department. So we've got to be on the lookout for those patients. Unintentional injury is the seventh leading cause of death in the elderly. And elderly patients have lower reserve. They have less pulmonary reserve and physiologic reserve. They've got weaker bones, which fracture more easily. They've got less muscle and oftentimes less adipose tissue also to cushion the blows. And that's going to produce greater injuries from what we would normally think of as a lesser impact. For many years, we've kind of discounted concerns with simple falls from standing height, yet we know that probably falls are the most common traumatic injury in the elderly and associated with the highest mortality. So don't blow off the patient who came in with a fall from standing height. These patients are at higher risk for head injuries in addition to torso injuries, largely because elderly are often less likely to be able to protect themselves and get their arms out and protect themselves from the head injury or other serious injuries when they are falling. Less bone density, less muscle mass. We briefly talked about that. Motor vehicle crashes is the second leading cause of elderly injury, and we'll throw in with that category being struck as a pedestrian as well. Elderly patients can oftentimes not get across the street as quickly, and if drivers are not paying attention, elderly oftentimes can be the victims of being hit by cars. Burns are quite common in the elderly as well. They account for 20% of burn center admissions. Don't forget about depression and suicide in the elderly. And of course, elder abuse is something that we need to screen for, just the way we do with pediatric patients. Who do you need to transfer to a trauma center from a community hospital? Well, there's not perfect literature on this. And the guidelines were, in my opinion, a little bit vague, but they said at least consider the possibility of transfer to a trauma center patients that have heart rates over 90. You know, gosh, that seems awfully nonspecific. But a lot of these elderly patients, remember, are on calcium channel blockers, beta blockers, and they also don't mount tachycardia in response to internal bleeding. So even a heart rate of 90 or 95, though technically not tachycardic, it should probably raise your concern. They generally have much lower heart rates because of the medications that they're on. Also, you want to keep in mind that these patients are at higher risk and may deserve transfer to a trauma center if they're on anticoagulation and or have signs of head injury and or have altered mental status. When evaluating the patients, just simple things. Don't forget, let them wear their glasses, let them keep their hearing aids on. That's going to improve their comfort and their ability to communicate. Bear in mind that elderly patients oftentimes are more difficult to intubate, especially if they have loose teeth or dentures. They may have redundant neck tissue. They may have spine arthritis and have less mobility when you're trying to use that laryngoscope, and also increased risk for temporomandibular joint disease, poor dentition, and so on. So don't be cavalier with these intubations. You know, how often do we say the most experienced intubator should do the intubation? You know, I kind of get tired of saying that and hearing that also. But just remember that these are difficult intubations in many cases. You're going to probably end up needing to use smaller doses of induction agents with rapid sequence intubation. And once you get them on the vent, this is really important, use lower volumes and lower pressure because these patients have stiffer lungs and are at higher risk for popping a lung and developing the tension pneumothorax on the vent. We mentioned this already, but I'm going to say it again. Don't rely on tachycardia as a marker of hypovolemia and hemorrhage because elderly patients don't mount tachycardia the way younger patients do, partially because of physiologic reasons and also partially because they're on beta blockers and calcium channel blockers that can blunt the tachycardic response. And these are not patients that you want to be conservative with imaging. You're not trying to spare them radiation. Be liberal with imaging and also lab testing. These are not the patients that you're trying to save money with cost-effective testing. Just go ahead and order it. I mean, if you need to, just shotgun. You're going to pick up some surprising things. And also, bear in mind that trauma in and of itself can produce delirium. And don't assume that confusion is just because the patient's elderly. But again, trauma can produce delirium. And so be on the lookout for these patients. All right, folks. Well, that concludes our summary of our three topics. I hope these discussions were helpful to all of you. Hope your springtime is off to a great start. And I look forward to talking to all of you next month. Bye for now.